The last case of the morning is number 052189, the United States against Gerald L. Sidwell. Mr. Haberman.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Alan Habermill. I represent the appellant in this case. I would like to restrict my argument to the suppression issue, if I may. I believe it's fair to say, after looking at the affidavit for the warrant and the arguments that have been raised, that the real crucial issue is going to be the controlled by. It doesn't seem to me that the magistrate was far off the mark when he referred to the references to the alleged intelligence as white noise, and that the business of Mr. Sidwell not letting the officer in without a warrant can hardly be used to support getting a warrant. There is the allegation then of there's that very vague allegation about baggy corners having been located in a hall, which is not attributed to any source, nor is there any time reference given for it. And it's framed in that odd sort of way, in that passive voice, have been located. The officer doesn't claim he found them. He doesn't say who he thinks did find them. He doesn't say when they were found. Plus, they're out in an open hallway. So it's hard to see how that adds anything. So you're left, really, I think, with this alleged controlled by. And on its face, that's obviously a problem. If it really did happen, then I'd have to admit that I think they got probable cause. So the question ultimately then boils down to, why do we believe that this buy actually occurred? And I think that's where the affidavit falls down. The courts, I'm sure, has probably seen hundreds of cases come up that involve controlled buys. You get some sense of how these things go down. And normally the officers are controlling the buy a lot more tightly, particularly when they're using a non-officer. I mean, there's a difference between using a civilian, although in this case he appears to be a professional snitch, but a civilian nonetheless, and an actual officer. And I'd certainly be much more inclined to take the word of an officer if he said he went in and did the buy than when you're using this kind of person who tends to be a criminal themselves to go in and do it for you. And the way you control those buys normally is you come up with some kind of surveillance, which they admit they did not do in this case. They watched the man disappear into an apartment complex full of apartments, and he comes back out sometime later with some cocaine. They have no idea personally what he did inside. They have to take his word for where he went and what he did. You would usually try to arrange for some visual surveillance or at least put a wire on him, and they didn't do any of that. The way the buy was organized is a little unusual. They would normally give him a set amount of money, tell him to go buy a specific amount of drugs, pre-record the money, make sure the drugs that come back match the money that went in, because they don't want these people ripping them off. And there's nothing in the affidavit about that. All they do is they say that we sent this guy in, apparently directed him to Mr. Sidwell's apartment, said bring us back some cocaine. The guy comes back with some cocaine. The fact is, it wouldn't have been that difficult under those circumstances for the informant to have actually faked this. Cocaine's a small substance, and because they don't say how much they sent him for, we can't tell. I mean, I grant you, if they said, go get us a pound of cocaine, he came back with a pound of cocaine, I wouldn't be telling you the man was carrying it around in his pockets. But in fact, crack cocaine in particular is often sold in very small quantities, grams, subgrams, little rocks, smaller than the tip of your finger sometimes. An amount that can easily be concealed, for instance, in the corner of a baggie and on your person. And while the officer says he searched him, the fact remains that you can get cocaine in a little paper bindle or a baggie. You can fit that in your shoe, in your sock, down your underwear, places I'm fairly confident the officer didn't search for. It doesn't say he stripped him down. They did a fairly, and in short, they did a not careful controlled buy.
Certainly this isn't the most controlled buy that certainly I've ever seen, but we had more than that because apparently this informant, according to the affidavit, had completed numerous controlled buys. Now, maybe all of them were sloppy buys, but, I mean, he did have a history, so that is another factor.
That is true. That's their way of trying to buttress his reliability. Although, again, conspicuous by the complaint is any actual factual basis. What you have is you've got these kind of generalized assertions by the officer. Well, he did a lot of stuff for us before. He's done a bunch of buys. He's led to warrants. But without seeing the details of that, it's very difficult to actually evaluate the weight of that. It's like half a step above just saying, well, we think the guy's reliable. They go a little further because we think he's helped us before. And I grant you, at this point is the point at which I've met in the lower court with a certain amount of polite judicial eye-rolling in the statement that the thing is kind of far-fetched. But, in fact, I think it isn't that far-fetched to say that the snitch could have just secreted that on his body. A person like that who's working for the police, as I argued in the brief, has a vested interest in maintaining that relationship and is probably a person, since he obviously knows a bunch of drug dealers and can get drugs on request, could easily have obtained that for himself and done this. And here's the thing about the case that really troubled me and why I really raised this is because, in fact, I think that the main reason that there should be some question about his reliability and the officer's claim about how reliable this informant is they came up dry. They didn't actually find the stuff that they thought they were going to find. And I think that does reflect, that's a fact in the case that does reflect on the validity of the inference that the snitch is telling the truth. There are two inferences, after all. One is we can believe him, in which case the buy actually occurred. One is we can...
Well, you wouldn't allow the inference to go the other way, would you?
I'm sorry, that...
If there was a search warrant that you were contesting its validity and the search turned up drugs, you wouldn't... Certainly wouldn't want an argument that, well, it must have been okay because that was there.
No, I appreciate the point that you would neither throw out a warrant nor sustain a warrant based on its results. That's true. What I'm trying to illustrate isn't that you should throw out this warrant simply because they didn't find it. What I am trying to illustrate is that it's not so far-fetched to believe that the snitch may have been making this up because this could occur. And, in fact, in this case, I offer you simply as an example of how that could occur. The snitch could go, come back out with the drugs, claim he got them in the apartment. And again, that's where I've been receiving some skepticism on that. But the fact is... And that it could occur, and in fact, I think in this case that is what occurred, because you find, in fact, when they search, they don't find any of the stuff that they think they're going to find. If the man's selling drugs out of his apartment to the point where there's baggies flying around the hallway and traffic's coming and going, and there's a control buy within 72 hours, and they've got this intelligence that he's doing this and these opinions that he's doing that, it strikes me as very odd that when they actually search the apartment, they find no evidence that any of that's going on. And this is why I say that it isn't so far-fetched that it could happen, because, in fact, it did happen. And so it isn't me just making this up. It isn't me just spinning, just whatever scenario I can think of that will somehow twist it the way I want it to go. It's a very real thing. And it's a question of bar setting. When this court looks at these affidavits, it has to set a bar at some level of how much information you're going to require. And the reason you want the bar, I think, higher than it was set in this case is exactly to prevent this kind of thing from happening. Searches going in on places where, in fact, what they believe is going on is not going on. Intruding into people's homes is a serious thing. It's a real thing. And I think the court needs to set the bar high enough so that you don't get these, I don't want to use the word false, incorrect affidavits, so that you don't do searches when you shouldn't be. And if that means, cutting out some that should happen, well, I think that's the choice, because I think it's better to not have the wrongful searches, even if that means you're weeding out some searches that could occur, than to set the bar so low that anything can get through, and then you start getting searches that shouldn't be happening. Given those choices, I think we should try raising the bar a bit, and I think that's what should be done in this case. And for the same reason that for the same reason I don't think good faith saves them, because it's that very officer who's setting all this up. He knows this snitch. If this snitch is prone to being unreliable, despite what the officer said, the officer would know that. He set up the control buy. He knows all of these things, and it's therefore his responsibility to do it better, and he's never going to start doing that if this court doesn't start telling him to do it. And when the court says, even if the court says the affidavit's bad, but we're going to save it on good faith, all that does is tell him to keep right on doing it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Habermill. Here now for Mr. Connell.
Good morning. My name is Paul Connell. I represent the United States in this case, and I was responsible for the prosecution of Mr. Sidwell below. At the end of the day here, what you have is a veteran informant who has been reliable in the past. He went in to Mr. Sidwell's apartment building, came out a few minutes later, claimed to have bought crack cocaine from him in a hand-to-hand transaction. He was able to accurately describe Mr. Sidwell and the interior of Mr. Sidwell's apartment to the affiant in this case. Officer Hassey. Officer Hassey, having been to at least the entrance to Mr. Sidwell's apartment before, knew Mr. Sidwell and knew what the interior of the apartment looked like. So the informant was corroborated. And then in addition to those things, you have packaging material for drugs found, not out in the hallway, but in the hallway right by the entrance to Mr. Sidwell's apartment. So if you don't have probable cause in this case, then you won't have probable cause in existence unless the police actually witnessed the transaction. Judge Williams, I agree with you. This wasn't the greatest control by ever. In my brief, I point out on page 6, he was wired up, but of course... the wire didn't work when he went inside, and that's sometimes, as you know, it's just the way it goes. Let me address a couple other things raised by Mr. Habermill. The fact that they didn't find drugs when they went into search, Judge Evans, I think you're right. I don't think he'd want that to cut the other direction, and the fact of the matter is, as you all know, is that searches happen all the time where you go on looking for one thing and you find something else instead. And with regard to the searching of the informant before he went in, there's nothing in the record as to how well or how poorly he was searched, but he was searched for weapons and contraband and given the money before he went in. Let me just touch on the good faith argument then very briefly. You know, this court has held the mere fact that the officers sought a search warrant as prima facie evidence that they were acting in good faith. The defendant can rebut that by showing that the judge abdicated his neutral role. There's no allegation of that here. Or otherwise that the officers were dishonest and reckless in preparing the affidavit or could not have objectively, reasonably believed in the existence of probable cause. And again, Officer Hassey, you know, takes care of the informant, sends him in, comes out, the informant says, I got it from Sidwell. You know, the appellant here has just failed to rebut that. And unless there are other questions from the panel, I would just rest on my argument here today and what's in the brief. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Connell. You have 1 minute, sir.
It happens all the time. They search for one thing and find something else instead. I call that fishing expedition. It shouldn't happen all the time. Ideally, it should never happen. There is a way to at least cut down on the incidents, and that's to make them do their job better. It isn't true that the officer says he saw the inside of the apartment, for instance. He says he had received information about it without explaining where that came from. It isn't true that the officer says he found the baggy corners and stuff in the hallway. He says baggy corners, quote, have been located by some unknown person at some unknown time. There was no serious effort at corroboration. If the guy's doing this kind of drug dealing where people are coming and going and coming and going, how hard would it have been for the police to come up with some way of corroborating that this activity is going on to where you could have some objective facts that would help bolster, for instance, the credibility of the informant? All of these things could have been done by the police. All of these things were not done by the police. That's their problem. That's not good faith. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Habermill, you serve by appointment of the court, and you have the court's deep thanks for your fine efforts on behalf of your client. Our thanks to both counsel in the case. It will be taken under advisement. The court has completed the call of the morning, and therefore we shall rise until the next regularly scheduled session.